This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you want to cut down on carbon, nuclear power plants offer you zero emissions. Nuclear power advocates have been saying this for years. But the fear of radioactive leaks and explosions from the past have meant that the pursuit of nuclear power in the U.S. and countries like Japan and Germany lags behind other countries like China and France. Could new ideas about nuclear power plants change that equation? Joining me now to discuss how startups could reinvigorate the pursuit of nuclear energy in the U.S., along with other selected short subjects in science, is Maggie Kurth Baker. She's a science journalist and author. She joins us today from Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Ira.
So from what I understand is that we're talking about startups redesigning from scratch nuclear power plants.
Yeah, so this is a story I'm working on for Popular Mechanics. And, you know, it's no secret that the American nuclear industry is in the doldrums. The next new reactor to come online should be next year, but it began construction in 1973. And last month, the Obama administration announced a series of new proposals that are aimed at increasing energy development by helping out these startups that are really interested in building reactors that could be smaller and cheaper and safer than what we use today. So, for instance, small business vouchers that help these startups get access to research and testing facilities at national labs.
Mm-hmm. So what makes them different? Why would they be any safer?
Well, partly because they're using different types of coolant. So what we use right now is water. And water can boil away if you don't have the electricity to keep pumping new water through. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to meltdowns like it did at Fukushima. So some of these have different types of coolant that can't boil away and different types of cooling systems that don't require electricity to be pumping. And they're based on, in a lot of cases, designs that were first tested back in the 1950s and 1960s, but abandoned for different reasons. So, for instance, one of the designs didn't end up getting used back then because it couldn't be used to produce fuel for nuclear weapons. So back then, that was a bug. Today, it's a feature.
Uh-huh. Let's move on to your next story. Last week, the International Summit on Human Gene Editing was held in Washington. And it turns out that tweaking the human genome is not off the table, but there are restrictions, right?
Right. So this brought together the U.S., the U.K., and China to kind of talk about what research was being enabled by CRISPR and hash out some of these big ethics questions that are surrounding it. And CRISPR, you know, as you know, is a tool that makes it relatively easy to target a specific snippet of DNA, cut it out, add new DNA in, shuffle things around. And a lot of what they were talking about was editing genes in humans, in our eggs, sperm, even embryos. And one of the hopes is that CRISPR could be used to eliminate genetic diseases, but we don't know much, if anything, about the long-term side effects of editing DNA that becomes a person and then passes those edits on to children. So the ultimate decision that came down is that it's okay to edit human DNA for now, but not if it's going to result in a pregnancy. This isn't legally binding, but it is kind of a peer pressure binding agreement that all three of these countries have decided to go along with.
You know, this comes up every once in a while, whenever some sort of new genetic engineering technology comes out. Well, it's not legally binding, will people? Is there some mad person out there going to make a real human out of this?
Could be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, I actually saw, I can't remember where I saw it, but there's actually someone developing a home CRISPR kit that you'll be able to send for, and not to make people, but to work on yeast and other things like that. Simple
oh, wow. Things. That's interesting.
Yeah. Let's talk about the first climate change refugees. I found this to be a fascinating story. We're going to have climate change refugees in the United States from the states themselves?
Yeah, so I mean, you could argue that the people who were forced to leave New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina could be counted as our first climate change refugees. But there's some debate over how much climate change affects hurricanes. And it's a lot of, you know, how much you can say that that was caused by climate change versus how much was that just a hurricane. Mm-hmm. Rising seawater, on the other hand, is a lot more unambiguously linked to climate change. And there is an island off the coast of D.C. in the Chesapeake Bay called Tangier Island There's about 700 people who live there, and the Army Corps of Engineers just put out a study estimating that it's going to be underwater in 50 years. So those people are going to have to move. And most of them are the descendants of European settlers who came to that island in the 1600s. Back in 1850, the island was about 875 hectares. Today, it's down to 320 hectares. And most of that even isn't what you'd want to build houses on. I mean, if you look at it from above, it's a lot of estuaries and marshland and just these little strips of ridges that everybody has their homes and businesses of the town
built on. It's officially 3 feet above sea level.
It's really, really close to being swamped already. There is actually another island nearby that has gone underwater, and during big storms, skeletons from the cemetery on that other island will wash up on Tangier Island.
Oh my goodness. That will drive the point home, I think, to anybody.
It kind of does.
Yeah. And at last, you bring us a tale of shipwreck and the tricky law surrounding posthumous plundering. Ooh, this sounds kind of interesting. What's lurking?
Yeah.
What's lurking underwater?
So what's lurking underwater is possibly more than $1 billion in gold, silver, gems, and other valuables that was on a Spanish galleon called the San Jose, which sunk off the coast of Colombia back in 1708. And we know all of that was on board because the ship's manifest that was filed in Spain still exists. And we can see what was supposed to be being shipped back to Spain from its colonies back then. Now, Colombia says that anything found in its territorial waters belongs to Colombia. There's also an American salvage company, though, that says the treasure is theirs based on them finding the wreck back in 1981 and having some kind of agreement with the Colombian government back then. And then, of course, you have Spain that's still coming around saying, hey, guys, we're Spain. We still exist. That's still our stuff. And it's kind of up in the air about who would have the better claim here. And a lot of cases with archaeology, it kind of comes down to whose cultural heritage the find represents. But whose cultural heritage would this represent? Is it Colombia's because it's in their water? Mm-hmm. Is it Spain's because it was their boat? Is it Peru, where all of the silver that was on that ship came from to begin with? You know, who does this actually belong to is a big open question.
All right. Well, we'll have you back when they settle that. Is it a deal?
Yeah. Sounds great.
All right. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about all these selected short subjects in science. Maggie Kurth-Baker, she's a science journalist and author, and she joined us today from Minnesota Public Radio. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side.
Yes, we have no banana. We have no bananas today.
Maybe you remember that popular song from the Roaring Twenties. That was Sam Lennon and Irving Kaufman. It was inspired by the fate of the Gros Michel banana that met a massive death at the hands of a fungus, Panama disease. And now it seems that bananas are in the midst of a second fungal comeuppance, but it might not be all that bad news. Here with the story and the good and bad thing about it is Roberto Ferdman. He's a Washington Post reporter who covers food, culture, and economics. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us about the bananas. What's going on? What's the bad thing first?
So the bad thing is that the extinction, or the near extinction that you pointed to, of the Gros Michel, which was also known as the Big Mike back then, is likely to repeat itself, or at least is understood by scientists as likely to repeat itself, agricultural scientists. The reason why the Gros Michel went nearly extinct and why we stopped exporting them to essentially the entire world is that this fungus called Panama disease that first appeared in Panama when it started ravaging Latin America, where most of banana exports are grown, spread very quickly and made quick work of the entirety of the banana plants that were grown in Latin America and exported around the world. Mm-hmm. The Cavendish, which is the banana that
everybody essentially buys in the store, right?
Everybody eats the Cavendish in the United States.
The monoculture, basically.
When you say banana, you say Cavendish in the United States. Just that's not very becoming. but it represents 99% of the export market. Right. And the reason why it was used in the aftermath of the near extinction of the Gros Michel is because it was resistant to the Panama disease. However, A new strain of the Panama disease appeared about 50 years ago in Southeast Asia, and recently, over the past few years, it has begun to spread to East Asia, to Australia, to Africa, to the Middle East, and agricultural scientists are now essentially sure that it is going to eventually make its way to Latin America, where the Cavendish is grown. And the Cavendish is not resistant to the new strain.
Oh boy. Wow. So how could there be any good news about this here then?
So the good news is that it took about 70 years or so for the Gros Michel to go nearly extinct, for us to stop being able to export the Gros Michel, and for commercial banana producers to produce it. So you don't have to start hoarding your Cavendish bananas right this minute. Because when it makes its way to Latin America, it'll be a matter of decades before we'll have to switch bananas, or we'll have to eat fewer bananas, or almost no bananas here in the United States. So the good news is that it's not going to happen very quickly, and that gives us a window, that gives scientists certainly a window, to either try to find another banana that is resistant to the strain and fit for commercial production, or to engineer a banana
right.
that fulfills both of those qualities, which are necessary of a commercial
That
banana.
Sounds like the more, I'm not going to say reasonable, but the more expectant in the age of genetic engineering is that they might try to engineer a banana that's resistant or find some way to fight it through some sort of biological means.
I mean, that would certainly be the upside to this, which we've pointed to, because when the Gros Michel was at risk, we had this banana, the Cavendish, that we knew of that was resistant to the strain. Right now, we don't. So it's possible that genetic engineering, which people are pretty averse to, certainly here in the United States in certain parts, could be what allows us to continue eating bananas.
Would they eat a GMO banana? That's what you're asking.
Well, it's GMO banana or no banana. So if you like bananas, you might have no choice.
And there you have it. Yes, we have some bananas, but not for so long. Thank you, Roberto.
Thanks
Roberto
for having me.
Roberto Ferdinand, reporter covering food, culture, and economics for The Washington Post in New York. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a key to success. A key to success in science is failure. Yeah, what happens when we remove failure from that process? Not a good thing. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, the narrative about science that receives lots of attention are those big eureka moments, the success stories, the breakthroughs, the cures, the discoveries. But behind every big innovation, there are countless failed projects that are literally swept under the rug. You don't hear about them. You don't remember them. Anybody remember the Apple III? But my next guest says those failures, the false starts, the dead ends, are just as important to the advancement of science. Science could not succeed without the failures. So what does science lose when you take failure out of the equation? How do we ingrain in teachers and students the value of failure and how to fail better? Let me introduce my guests. We're going to be talking about those. Stuart Feierstein is a professor of neuroscience at Columbia University. He's also author of the new book, Failure, Why Science is So Successful. He's here with us on our CUNY studio. Welcome back. Always good to see you, Stuart.
Nice to see you, Ira. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about that. I want to read one little quote. I was going to ask you, go into the big stuff about it, but then I remember a quote I read. In science, you not only have to have the stomach for failure, you actually have to enjoy the taste of it.
I couldn't agree more.
You're right. Explain that a little more.
Well, I think the crucial thing that we all learn as we become scientists is that these failures lead us down important paths. We have to be ready to take risks, many of which will fail, and we can't be disappointed by these failures. We can't be disillusioned by them. We can't be taken off the track by them. What we want is to develop a good taste for failure that takes us to a new place and be open to it.
Give me an example of how failures help us succeed.
An example of, well, there are
so many.
There's so many
in the book. Pick one out.
I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. The discovery of a particular kind of a receptor, which is called a G protein receptor. These are very important receptors. More than 50% of drugs on the market target these receptors. But they were very difficult to find originally, or the part of them was very difficult to find because the experiments continued to fail, and it turned out to be it was because of the solution they were washing the glassware in. which contained aluminum fluoride, and aluminum fluoride is an activator of these receptors, something we had never recognized. And this leads to the whole idea that trace metals right. are important activators of enzymes. Mm-hmm. So a failure leads to a brand new discovery that hadn't even been thought of before.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about failures on number 844-724-8255. I think an example that you talk about in the book that most people know about is the difference between Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein and gravity. If one was a huge failure. Talk yes. about the failure.
Yes, it's a terrible thing to say, but Newton, of course, had two little things kind of wrong, time and space.
Details.
You know, what can you do? So this is one of the remarkable things about science, of course, is that when you say failure in the common language, you think, well, kaput. It's right. no good. Just throw it on the heap. But that's not true in science. Science can fail for quite a long time and then be updated to something just a bit more correct. And this is really the process by which it works so well, is that it accepts an interim version of what the world is really like. Now, I mean, everything about Newton really works as long as you stay here on the Earth, more or less, or you stay within the solar system and you're looking at big objects. But if you want to know about, you know, the atomic world and the farther reaches of the mm-hmm. universe, the beginning of it, well, now you need Einstein.
Why do we never, ever hear about the failures?
I mean,
you know,
well,
we hear, you know, well, Newton's again saying, if I see further, it's because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yes.
But we don't know that maybe those giants have fallen over a couple of times.
Many times. We have developed, I'm afraid, this kind of heroic narrative about science, this what I call the arc of discovery, where, let's say, in physics, you go from Copernicus to Kepler to Galileo, Newton, Faraday, blah, 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 mm-hmm. Einstein, and kaboom, there you have physics. But that's not how it went. It took 400 or so years to make that trip, and there were many, many cul-de-sacs and failures and misunderstandings along the way that helped us finally come up with a fairly correct version. But I don't think there's a physicist around today who would say we've got a complete picture yet.
Yeah. So what are we losing if we crowd out the failure? What are we leaving out? That is useful to know.
Well, we're leaving out, I think, about 90% of science is the problem. And we have begun to crowd out the failure. We don't teach it in schools. Mm-hmm. We teach textbook versions of science, these arcs of discovery. We don't talk about the cul-de-sacs or the mistakes, the wrong turns, from which we learned a great deal. Embryology is a very good example of that. The whole field of embryology for a long time was mistaken about things, but it sort of felt phrenology is even better since I'm a neuroscientist. You know, the bumps on your head being something about your personality. Mm-hmm. That was a completely bankrupt idea, but for 50 years it operated as a science, and it still has foundational ideas that are important in modern day neuroscience.
Mm-hmm. Could we teach intelligent design as a failure?
Yes, I think I happen to believe that we should teach intelligent design in classrooms. Mm-hmm. I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to teach. Let's remember that Newton, Faraday, many great scientists would have believed in intelligent design. So I think we should teach it and understand it as, in my opinion, of course, a failure along the way, but not entirely. There are even things in it that are probably acceptable to evolutionary theory and can be wedded into it. And we should understand how we get from that to evolution.
Hmm. I want to bring on another guest to talk more about this, a school teacher who teaches this idea of failure to her middle school students. Helen Snodgrass is the science director of YES Prep Schools and an AP biology teacher. I'd never get into that class. At YES Prep North Forest School in Houston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're welcome. On your chalkboard, I understand, on your chalkboard, you have written out failure is not an option, it's a requirement. Why do you say that?
Yes, I do have that up there. It's definitely a quote that takes students aback a little bit when they first come into my classroom. But I have that quote up there for all of the reasons you all have been talking about. Students often come into science class with this idea that failure is wrong, not knowing the answer right away is wrong, doing an experiment and getting an unexpected result is wrong. And we know that that is so different from how the actual process of science works. So I use that to sort of catch their eye right away and sort of launch us into that year-long conversation of the real process of science.
Does it relieve them to know that they can fail and that takes some of the burden off and make them better students?
Yeah, I think it's initially a little scary because it's not what you're taught in school, that failure is okay. But I think over time, it actually does relieve them. I actually had, I talked to my students this morning since I was thinking about this discussion to sort of find out if their views had changed over the course of this year. And I had one student who said, you know, I really used to be embarrassed when I got something wrong or I didn't know the answer. And now I actually feel relieved and I understand that I'm not expected to know all the answers in any given moment. And I get to ask questions and I get to try something a different way.
Stuart, I see you nodding your head in agreement, and at the college level also.
Certainly at the college level. And Helen, let me congratulate you. It's a brilliant essay that you posted in the Washington Post. I just think it's exactly right in so many ways. I wish I were taking your class or had taken your class. And I think this is a critical thing because this notion of failure being acceptable and indeed being a requirement for the process, an integral part of the process, most of us don't get until we reach, frankly, graduate school when we're going to become professional scientists. That's when you learn that the answers don't really count for much. It's the questions you ask and that you fail a lot, but that you have to learn things from the failures. And it's unfortunate because for most of the population, I'm afraid, the last interaction they have with science is either a high school class or an early college class that's just based on the accumulation of facts and memorizing a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Helen should run the curriculum, if you ask me.
Well, I don't know about that.
Let's see what our listeners have to
say. I'm not sure she wants the job. But yes.
Talking with Stuart Feierstein, author of Failure, Why Science is So Successful, and also with Helen Snodgrass, who teaches failure in her school. Our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to join us. You can also tweet us at SciFry. How do you bring it in, Helen? How do you teach it in the classroom? How do you instill that? It's okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the first thing is just introducing students to the idea that struggle and failure are both normal and essential parts of science, because they're not going to come in with that idea. You know, one way I do that with that sort of provocative quote, and I also, you know, give them some examples of things that were initially perceived as failures, but ended up actually leading to something new and interesting. And I'm really excited about Dr. Feierstein's book, because I think I'll get a whole bunch of other examples for my class.
Yeah.
But another thing is just giving students the opportunity to struggle and fail by, you know, giving them more open-ended tasks and more open-ended labs to do where there isn't necessarily one clear answer or one right answer.
But, you know, our whole culture is built around success. I mean, no one remembers who lost the Super Bowl or the World Series. Well, I'll remember the World Series. But, you know, we don't think that second best or failure in those senses teaches us anything from it.
I don't think we're talking about failure necessarily in those senses. I mean, there are failures that aren't good. I can't suggest that everybody should just fail away, and that'll be just fine, of course. And it's not even a question of failing in order to become successful later on. It's the fact that if you embrace failure as part of the process, not the whole process, but a part of the process, then this is the place where you can be most creative, most innovative, where the most interesting things happen, I think.
Let's see if we can get a couple of calls in from our listeners. Let's go to Stu in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Hi, Stu.
Hello. I'm very interested in this topic. I'm a retired anthropology professor, and over the years I've taught a little bit of history of science in my intro classes, and one of the most important experiments in the history of physics, for example, was the Michelson-Morley experiment, and I frequently ask my physics colleagues, why don't you teach that? And they say, oh, it was a failure. And I said, yes, but it set the groundwork for relativity and for quantum mechanics.
Great point.
So I was wondering what Stuart Feierstein had to say about Michelson-Morley.
Okay, thanks.
That's often quoted as, of course, the classic version of how a failed experiment, a so-called failed experiment, an attempt to measure the ether and light as it sped through the ether, gave rise to almost a kind of a crisis in physics and finally to relativity. But that sort of thing happens, I have to say, again and again in science. Another example would be the one that I think we should still teach is caloric, the idea that heat flows, that it's a substance that flows. Now, we know now that that's not true. Heat is actually motion. It's the jiggling of atoms. Mm-hmm. But to get from the idea of caloric, because really, heat does seem like it flows. You put a hot thing next to a cold thing, and you can measure it as a flow. But it's not really a flow. And the idea that it's motion is the basis of thermodynamics, a subject that sounds so frightening to teach we would never try it. But it's really relatively easy to teach, I think, if you start from where we were wrong and see how we got to be right.
Helen, with such emphasis on testing and state exams, and how do you balance prepping students for what they need to know and then the idea of failure?
Yeah, I think that definitely presents a challenge to teachers. And I would say a few things to them, people concerned about that, which is one is that easy learning, the sort of learning we think of as, you know, test prep for a high-stakes test, it doesn't actually result in very deep or long-lasting learning. So learning that involves more struggle and, you know, more failure might initially not feel as good, but is actually going to lead to students understanding more in the long term, which we hope will show up on those assessments. The other thing I would say is that every teacher knows that students who aren't very engaged in your class are not going to do as well. So if you're presenting science as this long list of facts, a lot of students aren't going to be as interested or as invested in that.
Yeah. Well, I want to wish you good luck, Helen. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Helen Snodgrass, Science Director for Yes Prep Schools and an AP Biology teacher at Yes Prep North Forest School in Houston, Texas. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Still talking about failure with the author of the book, Failure, Why Science is So Successful, Stuart Feierstein. Do you think we can turn around and get people to understand, you know, the failure? I mean, certainly in this political season, right?
Yes.
No one wants to be looked at as being a failure or failing at anything.
Yeah, I think one of the worst things, if I don't want to talk about politics.
Yeah, good.
For sure. but I think one of the worst charges we make about politicians is that if they change their mind, they're flip-floppers. That's a terrible thing. We all should change our mind. If the facts change, you should change your opinion, you know, it's been said. And so I have no problem with people who revise their opinions about things or revise their ideas about things. One of my favorite quotes about science is that in science, revision is a victory. We're always revising.
Mm-hmm. Let's even get another phone call before the break. Eric in Gainesville, Florida. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how are you doing?
Hey there. Go ahead.
So I'm a graduate student in a physics program, and the competition is really hard or really tough. And I learn by failure. So like I do, that's how I'll remember something for a long time. And I feel like it's really tough in a graduate program where you're expected not to fail.
I'm not sure what graduate program you're in, but the graduate programs I know, I think, put up one of the things we do is we put up with a great deal of failure. I run a laboratory here at Columbia. We study the sense of olfaction as part of a neuroscience project. And I anticipate that my students will fail quite a bit. In fact, I have to say my experience and one that I've shared with many colleagues is that almost all the data that winds up in a thesis happens in the last 18 or so months of a graduate career that typically lasts 5 or 6 years. Pardon me. Now, it may be different in physics. I'm not quite sure of that. But in biology, I think we have a pretty high sense of failure that's okay for us. We have a very good tolerance for it.
Yeah, and in the world of invention is full of failure.
Right? Edison famously said, I found 10,000 ways to fail before the light bulb popped on.
You know? My favorite invention of a failure is silly putty. Silly putty was supposed to be a substitute for rubber.
Yep.
And it was one problem with it was dissolving water. But
yes.
It became a great toy.
Yes, Post-it notes, you know. Post-it notes were a failed adhesive. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't really stick, right? That's the problem.
Made a lot of money with that.
Yes,
with
pretty
that
good.
Failures. and that's the thing, is that you really don't know where a lot of these things are going to be leading to. They open the door. One thing is closed, opens the door to another idea.
I think that's the crucial notion here, that if we want to be creative in science, if we want science to remain, quote, successful, then we have to leave those doors open. We have to know where those places are.
When the government puts out grants, NIH, National Science Foundation, do they allow for failure in the experiment?
Well, this is one of my rants, if you will, of course.
You got a minute to rant.
Okay,
before.
Quick minute to rant. I mean, I think they don't. I think the funding levels are too low to put up with failure, and so grants become sales pitches. Famously, NIH and the NSF NSF, the other major funding group, have what are called high-risk, high-impact grants. So these are risky mm-hmm. grants, but they'll have a great impact. Now, last year, that was 1.5% of the NIH budget. So that's fine, but what does that mean, that 98.5% of the budget is going to incremental stuff that we don't really care about and don't expect to have much of an impact? That's not really the way we want to spend our money, is it?
No. Well, we'll talk more about it with Stuart Firestein, author of Failure, Why Science is So Successful. 844-724-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll take a short break. See you on the other side of it. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the importance of failure in science. My guest is neuroscientist Stuart Firestein, author of the new book, Failure, Why Science is So Successful, on the heels of your previous book, which was?
Ignorance, How Science is What Drives Science. Yes, ignorance and failure. I'm really carving out a little niche for myself.
But there's a sort of a link between the two, right?
Well, I think there's a crucial link between the two. I mean, first of all, ignorance, again, sometimes used in a pejorative sense, but I mean it in the better sense, that is the what we don't know in the world, and that's what science is about, finding out. But then there's, as Donald Rumsfeld famously told us, that what we don't know, we don't know. And that's what you find out by failing, really. So I think failure ties into ignorance by actually deepening it.
Well, let's see if we can go to the phones. We've got some pretty good phone calls here. Let's pick them up. Let's go to Peter in Chicago. Hi, Peter. Whoop.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mark Anderson.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes.
Hi. I've been listening with great interest. I'm a pharmaceutical scientist. I've been practicing now in the consulting area for 10 years, and I recall from my graduate school days, a very wise postdoc mentor told me that you have to measure success in terms of six-month increments. And I think the reason is, of course, is because most of your time is spent having these so-called failures. What I would also like to add, though, is as a practicing scientist over the years, I've had time to sort of organize things in my mind a bit, maybe not quite as refined as the author here, but what I find is that a failed experiment is one where the data is not good. So I think so long as you have reproducible data, if it doesn't answer the question that you've asked, it refines your thinking, makes you ask a different question, and ultimately leads to the truth. So I think I just wanted to add that point that, you know, to me, a failure in my job is when I can't do anything with the data. And anyway, I've been listening to this with great interest. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. You had some interesting stuff about data, talking about failure and data.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the caller is correct in that failures that are just due to sloppiness or poor data or not taking care or things of that nature, they're not interesting. No, there are uninteresting failures, and there are interesting failures, of course. There are uninteresting successes, frankly. I mean, some facts are, well, that's great, put that away and let's get on with it. So it's the interesting failures that are the ones that are important, and I'm not talking about those that are just because of poor technique or something like that. I mean, there's a wonderful quote from Isaac Asimov who once said that what every scientist wants to hear most when they see new data is not the word eureka, but, oh, that's weird, because that tells you there's something yet more that you haven't really surrounded yet somehow, you know.
Now, let's talk a little bit about how we teach science to kids in school. It's my soapbox every once in a while. And I think that we don't teach science enough about how science is carried out. We teach you how to titrate some liquid till the color changes, you know.
Yep.
But we don't teach you why science is important or, in the larger sense that we're talking about, why failure is important in science.
Yes, I think we leave out the questions and we leave out the failures and thereby leave out almost all the important stuff in science. And worse than that, we actually, I think, provide a distorted view of science that much of the public then has, which is that it's a big book of facts, that it's set in stone, that it's irrevocable. Worst of all, that it's the truth with a capital T, none of which I think any scientist would make any claim towards at all. Mm-hmm. But that is what we teach, and you're right. Now, I personally think the problem there is one of evaluation and assessment. I think it can be fixed, and I think it could be fixed quickly if we did some hard work on developing new tools, more refined tools of evaluation and assessment, things better than multiple choice exams, for example, that really only measure memorization.
It's a lot more good stuff coming from Stuart in his book, Failure, Why Science is So Successful. Stuart Firestein, Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you so
much. Hope you're working on the next one.
Thinking about the next one. It's always a pleasure to be here. I have a wonderful audience with great questions.
Thank you. And you actually can read an excerpt of his book on our website at sciencefriday.com/failure. The Paris climate talks look like they will run into overtime. A comprehensive draft plan scheduled to wrap up the meeting might be held over until tomorrow or later. We don't really know at this point as the countries wrangle over final wording. So how ambitious will the plan be? How will it be enforced? My next guests are here to give us the latest update. David Biello is the environment and energy editor at Scientific American. He joins us from talks over there in Paris. Hi, welcome. Welcome, David.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir. Well, that's good evening. Rob Jackson is an environmental scientist at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
So, David, where do we stand at this point? Because on this side of the pond, we're getting mixed messages.
Well, there are a lot of mixed messages floating around this conference center. So on the one hand, you have countries tearing down these elaborate booths they put together to broadcast or, telegraph their will to combat climate change while behind closed doors negotiations continue over how ambitious the deal will be, how transparent people will be about how they meet their ambitious targets and how much money will be available to help some of the poorer countries deal with climate change.
Will there be anything binding that comes out of the meeting?
Well, it depends on what you mean by binding. As Secretary Kerry put it, there are certain phrasings that would trigger legal review in the U.S. The Obama administration, as you probably well know or can guess, is trying to avoid Senate ratification, which is what happened with the Kyoto Protocol, why that went down in flames in the U.S. And so they're trying to avoid that. And that's why you can talk about legally binding, but the legally binding wording is unlikely to be there in the end.
Mm-hmm. They've been throwing around the question of the allowable rise of the global temperature, 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees Celsius. You know, does it really matter? Make a difference?
Well, the 1.5 degrees Celsius is meant to signal what I was talking about earlier: ambition. To say that we're going to be more ambitious. We're already at 1 degree Celsius of warming. We're going to try to keep it under 2 and even well below 2 at 1.5. So it's meant to signal ambition, and it's brought together this new coalition that's kind of reshaping the talks. They call themselves the High Ambition Coalition, and it's a union of rich and poor, big and small, so like the U.S., but also the Marshall Islands, the Gambia, and some other countries that don't usually associate with each other in these climate talks. And their goal is to make sure that the kind of existential risks of climate change are recognized in the final draft.
Mm-hmm. Rob Jackson, are these plans going to be able to keep us at these levels, do you think, as a biologist?
Well, first of all, there is a world of difference between 1.5 degrees and 3 degrees. I mean, in Fahrenheit, that's 3 degrees is about 5 degrees. So that's a lot. Is it, or will there be the kind of agreement that keeps us below 1.5 degrees? That's really challenging. 2 degrees is difficult enough. If we could keep global temperatures below 2 degrees, that would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And there's some good news, though, when it comes to emissions. You're an author of a study that showed that global levels were basically flat. They were steady last year. That must have been surprising to all of us to hear.
Yeah, it was a surprise. What we found in 2014 through the Global Carbon Project, a group that keeps track of global emissions of carbon dioxide, we found that emissions rose only slightly in 2014, But the surprise was that this year we project a slight decline in fossil fuel emissions. Now, we're still emitting more than 35 billion tons of CO2 a year, so the atmospheric concentration is still going up. But it's a good news scenario. It's an unusual pairing of flat or declining emissions with strong economic growth globally. That hasn't happened before.
So what is there any one large source that's not emitting that brought the levels down that you can point to?
Yeah, there are a couple of sources, but the biggest is China. China is projected to reduce its coal use by about 4% or so this year, and that's being driven by the kinds of news you're seeing on air quality. There are 1 million people a year dying in China from bad air quality, and many of your listeners saw Beijing declare its first ever red alert day just a couple of days ago. So China's doing everything it can to reduce its coal use and improve its air quality. And then a second factor that's getting a lot of attention is the meteoric rise of renewables. I mean, we're on track to deploy about 100 gigawatts of wind and solar power this year around the world. That would have been unthinkable 5 or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. David, do you find that there, and I've noticed this from reading the papers, but I wanted to get your view on it, that there appear to be major industry executives who are there who are really in favor of coming up with something that's got teeth in it so that they can plan for the future?
That's right. They, as they put it, want certainty. They were calling themselves the We Mean Business Coalition, if you will. And basically, they want to be able to know that if they build, say, a power plant, that it will be allowed to exist for the next 40 or 50 years, which is the lifetime of a natural gas or coal-fired power plant. That's the kind of certainty they want, and they came here to demand it. And assuming that we get a text of some kind tomorrow, an agreement among these 190 or so nations, they might get it.
Yeah, and Rob, if we are building plans on technology that doesn't exist, you know, maybe mitigation or actually sucking up some of the greenhouse gases, are we building a false foundation? I mean, how do you think this should be addressed in the plan that is being drawn out now?
There's a lot of discussion about technologies we call negative emissions. These are tools like using industrial processes to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it back underground. You can think of that as running, you know, a coal plant in reverse, essentially. So it takes a lot of energy. Another one that gets a lot of attention is biomass energy, like biofuels, coupled with carbon dioxide capture and storage. So these things are technologically feasible. They haven't been deployed at large scale yet. They're costly. They're probably 10 to 50 times more than current carbon prices around the world. And there are also social barriers. Each of these operations has to be sited somewhere around the world. So it's definitely an area that needs research, mm-hmm. something we need to look into. But there are a lot of impediments to doing this at a billion tons a year scale.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with David Biello and Rob Jackson about the Paris climate talks. You know, when you look on it, and I was doing research on this, I continually follow it, and you talk about new technology. I was just looking at a graph yesterday that showed that ancient technology is one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gassing, and what I'm talking about is cement. It's just making cement is 5% of greenhouse gases because there's so much CO2 that is emitted in the process. Couldn't we find a simpler way to do that? So is that low-hanging fruit, or does that require really some really new thinking?
Well, if that's addressed to me, Ira, global cement's about 5% of carbon dioxide emissions, and we keep track of it separately because it requires energy, obviously, to make the cement, but also the reaction itself gives off carbon dioxide. So can we find alternatives? Yeah, I think we can, but cement is abundant, it's cheap, and we're making more of it now than we ever have been around the world. So, mm-hmm. you know, a substitute isn't obvious.
Mm-hmm. So, David, let's talk about in the bottom line here from Paris. Is there going to be a plan for enforcement, how the countries will check on their targets in coming years? Will we see something soon, and will it be meaningful?
Well, as of now, there is supposed to be a new draft, and not just any old draft, but the final draft of the agreement that comes out 9 a.m. Paris time tomorrow. That's according to Laurent Fabius, who has been doing a fabulous job of running this COP, the most organized climate change negotiations I've ever covered. But there are a lot of issues that remain. So it will be interesting to see how those get resolved. I feel like China and the U.S. Both want a deal. They're obviously the two largest polluters. President Obama and President Xi signed a deal to try to get a deal and to combat climate change. So I think the prospects are good, but there are still countries out there like Malaysia, like Saudi Arabia, that are worried about the impact of a global deal on their fossil fuel economy.
And how has the U.S. government looked at in all of this? Being that virtually the entire Republican Party has just shrugged its shoulders on even paying attention.
Yeah, basically, the U.S. government is actually perhaps surprisingly seen to have some credibility on this, thanks to things like the Clean Power Plan and vehicle fuel efficiency standards that that the Obama administration put in place. But even these negotiators know that that the next U.S. election will play a huge role in determining whether this climate pact, whatever it says, moves forward or not.
All right. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. And we'll, are you going home soon, David? You're going to hang around for the whole thing.
I'm hanging around until they sign something.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll check back with you. David Biello is the environment and energy editor at Scientific American, camped out there in Paris. There could be worse places to be camped out in. Rob Jackson is an environmental scientist at Stanford University. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and happy holiday.
Same to you.
One last thing before we go. Public radio and all of journalism lost a strong voice for quality, accountability, and professionalism this week. Max Kakis passed away at the early age of 61. Max was a pioneering journalist. He was a teacher, a mentor, a community leader, and with a smile and a Facebook philosophy, we already sorely miss him. My condolences to his family and his friends. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Taliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Gruskin, our video producer. Production assistant is Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman is our engineer. At the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you like our holidays with a side of science, we've got a present for you. Go to sciencefriday.com/holidayscience, where you're going to find eggnog videos, do-it-yourself gift ideas, a Christmas tree experiment, and much more to spike or not to spike the eggnog. All your antibacterial answers are at sciencefriday.com/holidayscience. That eggnog video is worth the price of admission alone. Have a great weekend. Good holiday week. Hope you're staying out of the malls. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.